801.
Yeah, I've got 801, my.
Huh? Clown.
Okay, yeah, it's, I know it started, but that looks like it's been going for 5 minutes, and just wondering. Usually that one's behind. This time they maybe they set it ahead to kind of take into account. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I want to do a little bit more review today. Remember the quiz, chapters 37 to 42, which will be next Wednesday, a week from yesterday, and we'll review today. And if we need to, some more on Tuesday for the quiz, and then we'll resume our discussion of subjunctive. So. I think I'd mentioned to you in chapter 37 on the numerals, the only thing you'll be responsible for is the numbers from 1 to 4 on the test. And that's your section 298 there. And you'll be responsible for the various forms as well, you know, the paradigm.
I think you said 1 to 10.
Oh, did I say 1 to 10? Oh, okay, yes, I think I did. Yeah, right. All the forms for 1 to 4. That's what I meant. The numbers from 1 to 10 and the forms for 1 to 4. And of course, 1 to 4 are the only ones that have those declensions.
Just for the cardinals, or the
just the cardinals. Just the cardinals for our purposes. Yeah. If you know the cardinals, you'll probably recognize the ordinals. And that's the main thing. You know, I'm kind of wanting to give you what's needed for recognition. And actually, after you know the ones from 1 to 10, the rest of them aren't that difficult. They're usually combinations. You know, you hendeca, dodeca, and so forth. You know, you've got for the teens, and then once you just basically learn the forms for 20, 30, etc., then you have pretty much a pattern there. Okay, but for our test purposes anyway, that's all you need to know. 1 to 10 and the declensions for 1 to 4. Also in this chapter, just the main other thing is the recognition of allos and heteros, and similarities and subtle differences between them. Okay, any other questions on that chapter we need to go over? Mostly vocabulary, really, here. Then the negatives, the same thing, we just remarked about that. I think grammatically the only thing you need to be aware of is the difference between the oo forms and the may forms, and when they're appropriate, when they're used. Now at this point, since we don't get into subjunctive until the next test coming, you needn't be concerned about anything but the infinitives and participles, and using may with the infinitive participles, may forms, and the oo forms with the indicative. But we will see that the may forms are also used in the subjunctive. Perhaps that's where you see them used most frequently. Okay. So that, other than that, it's mostly vocabulary there. Maybe one quick remark on udes and maydes. Those forms are declined like hase, like the word for one. And you're just putting u or may on the front of it. And then, you know, and then a delta, and then the ending. So udes, udemia. Notice the feminine forms are going to take the mia, just like the feminine form of one. So udemia, you get an epsilon and then mia. So once you see the, you know, you might just take note of that pattern there, and then the rest of the paradigm will fall into place if you know the paradigm for hase. Okay, other than that, I think Eric had asked a question here, and just be responsible for the vocabulary there in section 298. You might want to review your workbook exercises on lesson 38 just to see how the things work. And I think you had some summary observations there, too, of the patterns that you see. So that might be good to include. Okay. Lesson 39 was dealing with questions, the various ways that questions are set up and structured in Greek. First, of course, he's dealing with English. We're not going to be worried too much about that. But things in English like word order, auxiliary verbs, interrogative function words, like interrogative pronouns, adjectives, and adverbs are the things that are used to set up a question. And so similar kinds of mechanisms are used in Greek. And word order, though, is notably absent in the Greek as an indicator of a question. And although you do have these interrogative pronouns and so forth, and you do have these function words that are very important. Yes?
Do you have the workbook?
Yes, I do. Thank you, brother.
Okay.
Okay. I did mention to you on the quiz, too, that you need to resume your reading scoring for the last, for the 2 weeks prior to, you know, when the test will be. Yes. Well, it's, that's right, we're only 3 hours this time. That's a good point. Let's see, last, I think we did it 5 times a week last year. I think it's really, I'd really prefer you to go 5 times a week, just to keep it current, you know. And it doesn't have to be, you know, broken up to 5 minutes each day, but on the average. In other words, it's better for you to spread it out as much as possible, get a little bit more frequent. For this kind of an exercise, it's better for you than lumping it all, saving it all up and doing 20 minutes in a shot or something like that. So I'll just leave that up to you. But just within the last 2 weeks prior to the test, if you've gotten 5 minutes a day, average 5 days a week, that'll be sufficient. Okay. And we'll probably relax that a bit once we get started to actually translating, because we're going to be doing it, you know, an hour a day pretty much. For the rest of the year after we get through the book here, with some exceptions. We'll be doing some other grammatical things from time to time, but we'll kind of intersperse those with our translating. All right. Well, looking here at section 301, mentioning the mechanisms for Greek, he first just makes the point that word order is not used in Greek to indicate a question. And that because of that, a given phrase in Greek could be either a question or a statement under certain circumstances. And the punctuation marks that the editors have supplied and so forth are supplied by the editors. It's not a foregone conclusion that the thing is obviously a question or not. You have to look at the context again. The context is going to have to be the decider. In some cases, there will be differences of opinion. Some cases the context is sufficient, but other cases it's not. So that's his main point, section 301. He gives a few examples of that. Now, section 302, dealing with the function words that Greek uses to indicate questions. And here we find, I think, perhaps the most difficult part of dealing with questions in Greek. The interrogative pronouns and things like that are pretty much analogous to English. The most unusual feature of Greek may be just this issue of whether a question is asking for a yes answer or a no answer, and of course, depending on whether it's introduced by ou or may. So here, section 302, Greek uses certain function words other than interrogatives listed in section 303 to indicate that a sentence is a question. None of these function words is an auxiliary verb like English do, however. So English uses auxiliary verbs, Greek doesn't, but it does use some other words. First, may, when used with the indicative mood, introduces a question to which a negative answer is expected. So a certain amount of information with regard to the expectation of the answer is indicated by this Greek word. In English, it's primarily intonation pattern that does the same thing. We can do the same thing, but it's primarily intonation pattern and a little bit of word order that makes the difference between whether you expect a yes answer or a no answer for a question. And so here, me he meis tu phloies, men, are we blind or we aren't blind, are we? And the answer that's expected is a negative answer. That doesn't necessarily mean that the answer will be negative. It just means that that's what's expected. That's the kind of expectation that's in the mind of the person who's asking the question. So that feature, then we've got meiti, is a longer form of may, occurs less frequently, so it gives a few examples of that, but it's functioning just the same. And then we have u, uk, or uch, depending on whether you're coming before a vowel or a consonant, and whether the vowel has a rough or smooth breathing. In other words, it'll be u before a consonant, it'll be uk before a smooth breathing, and uch before a rough breathing. And then uki, sometimes, used a longer form, sometimes introduce questions into which an affirmative answer is expected. Now, this isn't the only function of u. U can also mean the negative. But here, it's introducing a question to which an affirmative answer is expected. So, isn't this the son of the carpenter? See, ukutos estin hutu hotu tektonos huios. The idea there is that You're asking a question to which you expect a yes answer. Isn't this the son of the carpenter? Or this is the son of the carpenter, isn't it? There in English, of course, word order and intonation pattern are transmitting that information, but in Greek, it's the ou and the may makes the difference now. Of course, in both cases here, the ou or may are used with the indicative mood. And this is one of the very few uses you'll see may with the indicative. That's one time, in many instances, a good tip-off as to what you're looking at. If you see may with the indicative, be looking for a question. That's kind of a good rule of thumb to follow. All right. He makes that remark that ooh and so forth need not introduce questions, of course. They may just be the normal negative. So you have to watch out for that as well. And sometimes that can generate ambiguity, too. Example here, 1 Corinthians 9:1, uke mi apostolos, by itself might mean, I am not an apostle, as a statement, or it may mean, am I not an apostle? A question begging a yes answer. And then this little feature here, the may and the ou together. Now, we'll see ou may together as a double negative or an intense negative. But here, may ou, occurring in that order, would be may introducing a question to which a negative answer is expected, and then ou having its ordinary negative force. So the net result is a question that's expecting a positive answer, in effect. Yes?
So you're saying that this isn't... the double negative with which we usually think.
Right. This is not. In this order, may ou rather than ou may. May ou is going to be a question. And if you see the double negative we normally talked about, that's ou may. It's in that order. May ou would be introducing a question with may and then having a negative on the verb of the question with the ou. So it's a different structure. And here word order is important. So it says, may is introducing a question and ou is having an ordinary negative force. So here's one example, may uk ekusan, have they not heard, or they have heard, haven't they, or literally, they haven't not heard, have they? That's kind of the way, you almost have to sometimes set it up in a very literal structure just to see what's happening. But see, the point is that it... if you drop the ook out of there and just had may ekusan, you'd have something like, they haven't heard, have they? And then expecting a no answer. Now when you put the ou on the ekusan, then it's they haven't not heard, have they? Or they've heard, haven't they? That's kind of the idea that you get. And so you just kind of put a negative. This kind of gives you the real... Remember in English, if you put two negatives, it's a positive, as far as this kind of thing. And here, that in effect is working. You're expecting a negative answer with the may, but then the ou on the verb is going to eventually give you a positive answer. I mean, in other words, you're expecting a positive answer for the actual verb action, but you're expecting expecting a negative answer for the actual verb action as it turns out. But your question is set up where you're expecting a negative answer to something that's been negated. So the negative to a negative is ending up positive. It's a little bit of a... you're not going to run into this very frequently, but you do need to be aware of it. And if you see may and ou in that order, may first, then ou, then watch for this kind of a mechanism. And the best way, I think, to handle it is just to forget about the ou first. Just look at may and set up the thing according to what may would be expecting, and then add the negative into the verb on top of that, and I think you'll come out all right. Okay, any questions on that? It's not a big point, but it's a little bit of a sticky one, so it's why I call attention to it. Then there's the particle ara that's mentioned here, indicating impatience or anxiety on the part of the speaker. And we see that same particle with a little bit different accentuation later on. Okay, then section 303, interrogative pronouns, adjectives and adverbs. The pronouns, a form of tis, which you see the declension here. You have one form for masculine and feminine. It's a basically third declension format. So I don't think that presents any huge problems. This paradigm is pretty straightforward if you know your third declension. The neuter forms, of course, follow third declension neuter type format. So your masculines and feminines are using the same form, and then the neuters have a slightly different form, at least in the accusative and the nominative. Now, how these things are functioning are basically, and how you decline them, basically, tis means who or what or which or, you know, whom, something like that. In other words, all of our English words that have the WH on the front, all of our who, what, when, where, how, you know, I guess the how isn't there, but and the when, but the who, what, and whose, and which, and to whom, and whom, all of that is governed by this one word in its various declensions. And I think the system makes quite a bit of sense in Greek. And, of course, there's evidence that the who, whom, and so forth that we have and whose come from case endings. You know, German, of course, has case endings on their nouns, and this may be a remnant of that origin. Anyway, to decide what you're looking at, you're going to need to look at the case as well as the number and gender of the form of tis to know really what you're asking. If you're putting the tis in the nominative, for example, you're asking for who is the subject of the action. See, who is my mother? There's a predicate construction. Somebody, you know, is your mother, and you're asking for who that one is, and you're asking for the noun that fits into that structure of a predicate construction. And then tina zeteta, whom do you seek? There you're asking for the noun that is the direct object of the idea of seeking. You are the one that's seeking, and you're seeking something, someone. And that someone that you're seeking is the thing that's in the question, and therefore it's going to be an accusative case. So in other words, whatever you're asking for, whatever piece of information you're asking for, whatever fills in the blank, you see, sometimes you're asking for the subject of something, sometimes you're asking for the object, sometimes you're asking for a genitive, see, tinos, he ekon, ekon aute, whose is this image? In that case, you're asking for the one who's possessing the image. And that would be a genitive. You see, if it was a statement, this is the image of Caesar. Of Caesar would be in the genitive case. And therefore, in the question format, since that's the piece of information you're looking for, that's going to be in the genitive case. So you have tinos. Or tini here in the dative, in the Matthew 11:16, to what shall I compare this generation? There you have a dative idea. This generation compared to such and such. And it's not so much an indirect object here, but a comparison construction, but it's typical of a dative use. So that's the idea there. It's something to watch for. It may be something that's kind of run through fairly quickly here, and maybe something that, you know, it typically in the past, you know, I've seen problems arise from this, just wondering, what case should I use? Did I just use tis all the time or what? No, it's not always going to be tis. It's going to be, what is the question really trying to ask? What kind of information are you asking? And so you have to kind of decide, where would, if I had the answer to the question, where would the thing I'm asking fit into the sentence? And then put your form of tis to be appropriate to that. Yes, John?
The difference between tinos and the masculine feminine are going to be contextual.
Yes, yeah. It'll be contextual. Because of course, it's going to make a difference as to whether you're asking what or who. In other words, it makes the difference between persons and generally. Generally, when you're using masculine and feminine with tis, you're talking about people. Either male or female. If you're using neuter, unless you know, it's conceivable that you might have a context in which tis might be masculine just because the noun that fills in there, you expect it to be masculine. But usually if you're asking a question, you don't know. You don't know what's going to fit into it. Unless there's certain kind of a context where it's quite predictable, where there's a choice of this or that, and both of them have masculine nouns or something like that, that conceivably could arise. But by and large, you're going to see the tis being used for male or female. And of course, it could be either one, so you don't really, you know, oftentimes questions are set up in such a way that you don't know whether it's male or female anyway. So, but as far as neuter, usually the neuters are pretty clear. It's what? And you're asking for an object. Of course, in the genitive and dative, they're going to be the same anyway, so context is going to tell you there all along the line. I can't think of an example where this is really critical as far as, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity is concerned, but there are instances in which this recognition of the grammatical functions of gender are really important in not making some errors in assuming personality when there isn't necessarily personality there. But when you're asking for a question, you know, usually you've got something in mind. You're talking about people performing actions, and the idea of personality would be appropriate. Okay. Does everybody have the general idea, though, what's happening here as far as these questions are concerned? Now, of course, in English, TIS will be translated differently. It may be translated who, whom, to whom, whose, which, what, depending on whether it's masculine, feminine, or neuter, and depending on whether it's the subject, the object, the indirect object, or genitive phrase. But it's really, if you think of all of those words as really the same word in different cases and so forth, then in genders, then you may see more parallel between English and Greek. Okay, then there are also interrogative adjectives, where you may be asking for an attribute of something rather than asking what the subject of a verbal action was or object or something of that nature. So the pronoun tis may be used adjectively. And in addition, the adjectives poios, which, what kind of, posos, how many, how much, felikos, how great, occur in the New Testament. So these are all interrogative adjectives. So they function like adjectives, but they're asking a question about, you know, it's kind of you're looking for the actual adjective that fits in there, and you're asking about what that is. So you can use tis this way, just because I suppose you could think of this maybe as a substantive, or you might think of it as a substantive being used as an adjective. What reward do you have? You see, what reward? Tina misthon. It's kind of what kind of reward, something of that nature. That's the idea. What reward? Which reward? And that's an adjective. It's functioning like an adjective, modifying that noun, but you're asking for what reward. In other words, you're asking for a description of the reward. You're asking for the adjectives that apply to that reward. Big reward, small reward, a reward of heavenly reward, earthly reward, whatever. In other words, when you get the answer, there'll be certain descriptive adjectives that apply to the reward. And then poios, this may perhaps even more obvious, means what kind of. So poios somati erchontai, with what kind of body do they come? The idea of with is coming from the dative case here, the instrumental kind of an idea. Yes?
To decide whether it's some case, whether it's an adjective or idea or idea, is that determined by the kind of answer you get?
Well, the kind of answer and also the kind of structure that's set up here. For example, now remember, an adjective is going to agree with its noun in case, number, and gender. And here, tina misthon, you may not see it right off the bat, but if you notice that these are both accusative and masculine, singular, you see that this form of tis is going right with that noun. So you can kind of pick it up even from the Greek right there, the fact that they're in the same case and so forth. What was that, John?
It's going to be the proximity to, the adjective.
Yes, it'll be in proximity to the adjective. It'll be attached to the adjective also. Now, there could be some structural ambiguity in this one because it happens to be a neuter, and the neuter's forms for the accusative and for the nominative are the same. So a person perhaps could analyze the tina as the direct object and misthon as the nominative subject. However, the verb wouldn't fit then. Then you'd have a reward has what? And usually rewards don't have things. So I mean, you might have a strange context or something. What was that? Yeah, you'd have unless you had a real wild poetic context or something in which you were personifying things and so forth, you wouldn't see that. So that's the kind of thing, context can come into this if there's certain ambiguity structurally. But if you see that the adjective, if you see the form of tis is fitting into an adjective position, that is going to be an indicator. That plus context, I guess. Okay. Poia entole megale entonomo, which is the great commandment in the law? Here again, you're asking which commandment, same kind of construction as we saw above with tis. Then posos, how many or how much, indicating degree, magnitude. Posus artus echete, how many lobes have you? That's pretty straightforward. I don't think you'll ever run into much confusion as far as that one is concerned. But again, notice that its forms are going to agree with a noun that is modifying. How much, how many loaves? So artus, loaves, accusative plural, and then echete, how many loaves do you have? Again, talking to you. And that's another point about the first example, tin on this, though, and echete, that Glenn was trying to bring out, is that echete is second person plural, so you're addressing some person, and that's the subject. You have what? And the other, and, you know, grammatically, the other has to be the direct object. Okay, otherwise it would be a third-person form of the verb. Then, pelikos, in the New Testament, occurs only in exclamations. Pelikos, you mean, gramasin, egrapsa, with what large letters I have written unto you. Pelikos, meaning how great. Okay, so how great a letters, and what large letters I have written unto you. Then the adverbs, those, of course, don't decline, so those are a little bit easier. That's mainly vocabulary, so you should be familiar with these. Pu, poten, pote, pos, posakas, and t, meaning why. T is kind of like tis, but it's just used adverbially here, and you could think of it maybe as what, for what, or through what. There is a d, diati, why, or on what account. Through what, you know, is the idea that's used. That's given as another remark there. So it is related, but it's functioning adverbially. And we've seen adjectives functioning adverbially before, so there shouldn't be any surprise. Okay, those are real straightforward. I don't think there's reason need to go through those individually. It's just a matter of learning the vocabulary. There's no declension involved. Generally, the word order, if you're asking a question, you'll see in all these examples that this form, poo or pothen or pote, whatever, comes first in the sentence. Because you want to try to transmit the information that you are asking a question as soon as possible. That happens in English, too. I don't think there's a rigid rule about that in Greek like there is in English, but that's the way that you normally see it. Okay, then indirect questions in English are a little bit different than direct questions. In Greek, there's not much difference at all. So indirect questions in English are introduced by the same interrogatives as are used by the direct questions, who, what, and so forth, and also by whether and if. The tense of the verb in an English indirect question depends on the tense of the main verb. Direct question here, for example, in English, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? The indirect question, they asked him whether it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath. This point is that we've changed the verb form from is it lawful to whether it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath. And that change is dictated by the tense of the narrative, which is indicated by that lead-in phrase. They asked him, past tense, you see. That, if you've got a direct question, you can say they asked him and then give a quotation, give the exact statement that was stated in the tense that was appropriate at the time it was stated. And that would, of course, give you that first tense. In the second example, we will change our verb form, if it's an indirect question, to the past tense also. Now, the difference is, in the Greek, that doesn't happen. Direct questions may be introduced by the same interrogatives as those used in direct questions, in addition by a, whether, or if. In Greek, however, the tense of the verb in the indirect question is always the same as it would be if the question were direct, which makes it a little bit difficult to tell the difference between a direct and an indirect question. But the idea is that they seem to be projecting that time sense of the actual action, whether it's a direct or indirect question, whether they're giving a direct quotation of it or whether they are recounting it, they will seem to have a tendency to project that time sense. This would be interesting. To me, it would be curious to see whether this is a koine feature alone, whether it's a New Testament feature, or whether it's done all the time in Greek. It'd be an interesting thing to check. The reason I say that is because Hebrew tends to do things like this. It tends to project you into a certain time frame. Those of you in the Hebrew class are familiar with the walk executive and that kind of a function. It'd be interesting to see if this has any connection with that in terms of Hebraism or not, but I don't have any information to, you know, corroborate that one or the other. It may just be a feature of Greek and seen in classical and so forth as well. Now, he does mention a point about classical Greek here, but it's not the same thing. Classical Greek made use of special indirect interrogative pronouns, adjectives and adverbs, hostis for tis, hopos for pos, hopoios for poios. These occur with these meanings only very rarely in the New Testament Greek. A few other types of questions do occur. These will be considered after the remaining moods of the verb have been discussed. So we haven't really covered all of the questions, but have to get into the subjunctive mood to cover certain types. Okay. So there, a lot of this chapter is vocabulary, and as far as declension is concerned, you will be responsible for tinos, for tis in its various forms, and then the rest of the vocabulary here. So you may want to make a vocab list for it. I don't know. Might be more convenient. Okay, any questions about the functions and the grammar and so forth there? All right, relative clauses, chapter 40. These, again, are some of the most important grammatical features of Greek. Very common, just like participle phrases are very common. And the discussion here in section 305 is just an introductory survey of what's happening both in English and Greek, and he's talking about the fact that the form who is used in questions, indirect questions, direct questions, quotations, and so forth, but it's also used as a relative. And the first three sentences there, who is coming, we shall ask them who is coming, we shall ask them who is coming without the quotation, and then this is the man who is coming. The first three are all some form of question. The last one, though, isn't a question at all. And there is the form who is being used as a relative pronoun. And so he's introducing this concept of relative pronouns. And the relative pronoun is a way of combining two sentences into one. And using a pronoun, see, generally when a pronoun is used, it's used to replace a noun, and it's used in a situation where the noun has already been mentioned in the previous context or somehow obvious what the noun is, and you can get away with using a pronoun. And in a relative clause, that's essentially what's happening. A pronoun is being used rather than repeat the noun, and it's being tied to the previous clause somehow. So if you take two sentences, this is the man and the man is coming, put them together, you can get this is the man who is coming, and use your relative pronoun. All right, now the section 306 gets into what the Greek does. And this form who in Greek is the same form as it was in the interrogative, tis. And then it has another form, hos. So tis, we saw, is used to introduce direct or indirect questions. Excuse me, this is the one that's used for the questions. And then hos is used for relative clauses. And the paradigm for hos, given at the top of the next page, you'll see that it's parallel to what we saw for the article. There's a lot of connections between the relative pronoun and the article, although there's no taus on any of these forms. And notice there's also a rough breathing on all of the forms. So if you remember there's no taus and there's rough breathing on all the forms, other than that, remember the article, you'll have it. Yes?
I don't
need to know
the accent for
that. Well, no, I'm not going to be really stressing accents here, just like we haven't in the past, except you know, where an accent would make a difference in the forms. Are you concerned mainly about the relative pronoun, about host here?
Yeah, I was thinking
yeah. Yeah, it's not too hard to remember. If you just remember this quick thing, and the same thing is true of the article. It's going to, except in some of the articles you don't have any. But you're going to have an acute accent in all the forms, except for the nominative and accusative forms, all the way through, have the acute. The genitive and dative have the circumflex. So, you know, if you remember that, you have it. So it's kind of, just remember several things. No taus, rough breathing on all of them, and circumflex on the genitive and datives, and acute on the rest. And that'll make it pretty straightforward, I think. I do like you to remember that there is an accent on all of these relative pronoun forms, lest they ever be confused to see where the article ho, and the relative pronoun ho, for the neuter, can be confused sometimes. And the difference is the accent. The article doesn't have the accent in the relative pronoun does. Okay. But as far as accents in general are concerned, I wouldn't worry too much about those. But I think, I guess, you know, for this relative pronoun, it'd be best to make sure you get the accent down. The interrogative, you don't need to worry about so much because it's pretty straightforward. It's, you know, spelling is going to pretty well indicate it. All right. Then he gives the Greek equivalents of those previous sentences. The first three all use some form of tis because there's some kind of a question idea involved. And the last one uses os. All right. He mentions this summary point here in section 307 that all of the no forms of the relative pronoun begin with tau and that all of them are accented. That's your main difference between that and the article. Now, the use of the relative pronoun, section 308. The forms of hos correspond to English who, whom, whose, which, what, which, that, and what. The context determines which English form should be used. So just like the interrogatives, these same words now as relative pronouns are coming across in different cases and genders. And here we do have, of course, masculine, feminine, and neuter separate forms for all three of those. The gender and number of a relative pronoun are the same as the gender and number of the noun or pronoun to which the relative pronoun refers. In each of the illustrated sentences below, this noun or pronoun, called the antecedent of the relative, is printed in boldface type. Okay, gender and number are going to be agreeing with the antecedent, but not necessarily case. See, we had adjectives agreeing with their nouns and case number and gender. But the relative pronoun will not necessarily agree in case because it will be functioning differently in its clause in general. It may the pronoun is going to tack itself onto the antecedent by the use of concord rules involving gender and number. But as far as this case function is concerned, generally, you know, it's hard to say generally, but let's suppose the basic rough and ready rule is that it's going to have a case that's determined by its function within its clause. Now, there is an exception to that in the case of attraction, section 309. So, under certain circumstances, when the thing ought to be an accusative case and its antecedent was genitive or dative, they're going to tend to attract it to the case of the antecedent. So, that's something to take note of. Now, as far as this test is concerned, what you're going to be seeing is Greek and have to translate it in English, so you'll already see it done pretty much. And so I don't think it's going to be that much of a worry or bother, except that you do need to note that the case of the antecedent is attracted in some cases. And I think that we've kind of established as a rule of thumb as far as exercises are concerned that only in the case where the relative pronoun ought to have been in the accusative case according to its function within its clause and its antecedent was genitive or dative will you see this attraction rule. So let's just, you know, operate on that basis as far as exercises so there won't be any ambiguity in what you are to do. On the test, I don't think it's going to be too much of a problem because we're going to go from Greek to English. And in translating, it's not going to be much of a problem except to note it. I suppose the biggest problem would be if you're reading along and you see that happen and you're wondering, what does this fit back to or what's happened here? This ought to be an accusative case. We've got something here in the genitive case that's functioning like an accusative. What's going on? If you're aware of it, then you won't have to look very long and you'll see what's happening. Okay, does everybody follow that and what we mean by that? So section 309, you'll be, you know, responsible for recognizing that, but I don't think it's going to be a big issue on the test as far as if you know that that's what's happened, there won't be any problem for you. So you're going to be translating the relative pronoun as if it were accusative when it happens to be in the genitive or dative, just because of the antecedent. All right. Don't know if we'll take time to go through those examples unless you feel like you need to. This little mechanism of tying the relative pronoun to its antecedent with case and number is handy. It won't resolve every conflict, but it'll give more precision than English does. In English, we don't have that refinement, so we may say which, and the which might refer back to any one of several things in the previous context. Whereas in the Greek, the which may refer back to only, in other words, the only candidates are things that would be, say, neuter, singular, whatever the case happened to be for it. And that can give you some more information. It can resolve some questions sometimes. It can help theologically sometimes. There's this one issue, for example, in 1 Timothy 3:16, where the manuscripts are in conflict, and the best manuscripts say, rather than saying God was manifest in the flesh, they say, Hos, who is manifest in the flesh? And Hos, you see here, is your masculine nominative form. So its antecedent would have to be something masculine and singular. And the antecedent that a lot of people try to point to is mysterion, which is neuter. And you would have to have ho there and not host in order for that to be the antecedent. And so the antecedent has to be something masculine and singular, and the only thing in the context that fits is either God or Christ, and theologically Christ doesn't fit because Christ wasn't manifest in the flesh. And so God is really about the only thing you can end up with as far as the concept is concerned. So the things like that will help. It'll help you theologically sometimes. Now, many times it won't help because maybe there were two or three things that were masculine and singular. Then you're back to the same place we are in English. So you kind of have to hope that the nouns will be of different genders and so forth in order to really be able to specify it more accurately. But it does give an additional help that English doesn't have in many instances. Okay. The rest of these are fine points. As far as the relative pronoun is concerned, through section 310, there are long forms, hostis, hatis, so forth, and those, I'm not going to be too worried about. I think you need to be aware and recognize those as longer forms. But paradigmatically, there isn't much of a problem there, and there's only a few attested forms to it. So just take note of that. The main thing, though, is that those longer forms are never attracted to the case of the antecedent. They always retain their normal function within their clause. Okay, section 311, relative clauses occasionally precede their antecedents. This order may be altered when translating into English. That's a little strange to us. We seldom will do something like that. But in Greek, it does happen. So, hos eche dothesitai auto, to him who has it shall be given. Okay. Hostis, there's a longer form, same thing, to him who has it shall be given. And so, literally, to him who has it shall be given, to him is a little bit redundant in the Greek. But the auto is the antecedent to the relative host, but the auto is coming after the antecedent. And so we can do that in English too, but it's usually poetic. It's usually got more of a poetic tenor to it. We normally will use the relative clause afterwards. We normally say it shall be given to him who has, something like that. Okay, the antecedent of the relative pronoun need not be expressed in Greek. In translating into English, however, it is usual to supply one. This is usually where you have an antecedent that's indefinite, and it may be he or she or something like that. So, hos ou gestin kath himon, uper himon estin. He who is not against us is for us. Well, here in the Greek, it's just who is not against us is for us. And so we're supplying a he who. We're supplying a he as an antecedent, a pronoun antecedent to the who. And it's just the way we speak. Although you can get by, who is not for us is against us, I suppose, more in a poetic context. But it wouldn't be real the normal way of speaking. So he's just saying that in English you go ahead and supply that he. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering the difference between section 310, hostess.
Yes.
And section 304, indirect question, hostess,
Milan
for his.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the same, but one says in 304 it says hostess is a derivation of tis, and 310 hostess is a derivation of host. What's the difference in use?
Well, the difference in use would be one's used in question situations and the other one's used in relative pronoun situations. So that'd be the difference in use. The difference in form, there isn't any. And you can see why they're...
It's the same word.
Yeah, it's the same. We'll see. Look at...
Really, is it the same word?
Well, that's a good question. It kind of depends on how you define a word. If you define the word in terms of its function and use, they'd be different. If you define the word in terms of its form, they'd be the same. See, that's kind of what they're doing here, in effect, is they're wanting to separate these in your mind. And so they define one as being derived from tis and the other one as being derived from hos. But the form is the same. So you're kind of picking one half or the other half. And that's the reason they pick that is just because of the way the thing is functioning. You're not going to see these long forms hostis as relative pronouns very often. Section 310 isn't going to occur very often. But I would say, yeah, it's probably the same word. I think in Greek, as far as their mind is concerned, it's one word, and they've got a different context in each place. And the different context is saying, here we're going to translate it as a relative pronoun. The other place we're going to translate it as an interrogative. But of course, even in English, the translations come out pretty much the same. Who, what, you know. And here in one sentence, the who might be a question. In the other sentence, the who might be a relative pronoun. So it's kind of parallel to what English is doing there. So I guess your context is going to have to be your guide in that instance. When you see a form of hostess, to tell whether it's interrogative or relative, context is your guide. And that may, of course, generate some ambiguities. I don't know if it actually turns out to do so in the New Testament or not, but it's a potential source of some. Okay. Any other question on that? So, same form exactly, but differences contextually as to whether you're dealing with a question or not. Section 311, relative clauses. Oh, I guess we did that one. 312, antecedent relative pronoun, you have expressed in Greek, so we covered that. That's more like a substantive. If you kind of think of it as the relative pronoun without the, you know, a relative pronoun is relative. See, it's got to be attached to something. If you don't have something there, you have to kind of supply to something. And so you get he who or the one whom or, you know, we'll do that in English. Similar to what we did with an adjective. An adjective normally is attached to something. It's attached to a noun. If we see an adjective used all by itself, not attached to a noun, then we supply a noun in the form of he or who, he who or whatever, to do the same thing. So it's analogous to that kind of thing. It's analogous to a substantive type of use. All right. Relative pronoun itself is frequently omitted in English, but it is never omitted in Greek. Sometimes in English we can just slip that thing out and by our clause construction imply it. In Greek you won't do that. So apen moi panta ha epoiesa. He told me everything I did. So in English we can say he told me everything I did and leave the ha out there, out of it. But in Greek you'll always see the ha. You won't leave that out. And so we will in Greek always say everything that I did, everything which I did. It'll always be there. In English we can get away without it. Section 314, when the neuter forms of the Greek relative occur without an expressed antecedent, they may often be rendered by English what. So neuter forms, they're dealing with usually objects, inanimate things, non-personal things, and so it's very appropriate if they don't have an expressed antecedent to translate it what, that which, you know. See, in other words, what is in this use is kind of equivalent to the phrase that which. Kind of supplying that and then the relative pronoun. So what I tell you, I tell all, or that which I tell you, I tell all. If you use that which, it kind of is more of equivalent to what we saw before. So he mentions this, in this use, English, what is sometimes called a compound relative, it is as it is equivalent to that which or those which. And that would put it into the same category as section 312 there. He who, it's just a neuter form, that which. So it's really the same thing, except that in English we will sometimes streamline that down. Okay, you've got five more minutes here. There's, in section 315, this is more of kind of a curiosity, I suppose, a thing to note about parallels in construction. The fact that it's possible to render things, certain types of sentences anyway, with either a participial phrase or a relative pronoun phrase. And it is obvious the relative clauses may express many of the meanings expressed by the articular participles. So here we find pas hostis akoue, everyone who hears, and then pas ho akouon, everyone who hears. Now this works only though in certain instances. Your participial phrases are more limited in their range than the relative pronoun phrases. Relative pronoun phrases, you can get a lot more different nuances than you can with the participials. But there will be parallels in the participial phrases. It's in instances where the thing that is involved is the subject of the verbal idea. In other words, you can only use this equivalence in cases where your relative pronoun is in the nominative case. In other words, the relative pronoun is the subject of the verb in its clause. When you do that, then you can substitute a participial phrase. So the one who hears, you see, could either be hostis akoue or, you know, pas hostis akoue or pas ho akouon. However, if you If you find that the relative pronoun is something other than the subject, then you're not going to be able to use participle anymore. You'll have to use your relative pronoun construction. Okay, so we have an example here, the man who says these things. Ho aner hos lege tauta. That could be equivalent to ho aner ho legon tauta, the man who is saying these things, using a participle. But ho aner hu tus logus aku, the man whose words I hear, there you can't convert that into a participial construction. Because now it's the man whose words I hear. I'm the one that's hearing. There's a different subject to the verbal idea than the relative pronoun. The pronoun is no longer the subject of the verbal idea, and so you can't use this participial phrase. A participle is always going to be the subject. I mean, if it's substantivized, that's the substantive sense to it is going to be the subject of that verbal idea, not in this case and a genitive in a phrase relative to that verbal idea. And then the same thing, ho aner ho edoka tain entolain, the man to whom I gave the commandment. Here, the man is the one that's the indirect object. And so we are not going to be able to use that construction. Then ho aner hon edon, the man whom I saw. Same situation there. It's the direct object now. The relative pronoun is the direct object. So might just put it this way. When your relative pronoun is the subject of its verbal action, in other words, when you see a relative pronoun in the nominative case, you can use also a participial phrase. But if the relative pronoun is in any other case than the nominative, you're not going to be able to use the participial construction. Now, that doesn't mean that participial constructions can't be used in something other than the nominative case. They can be. But they are going to be, that whole phrase will be the direct object, or in other words, that whole thing. You're not going to be able to split functions up within the relative phrase. The whole thing kind of stands or falls together one way or the other. In other words, you could say he spoke to the one who heard him or something. There you could have an indirect object and have a participle phrase there. But when you have the relative pronoun itself in one of these other cases within its clause, then it's got a certain relationship within that clause that has to be preserved in order to transmit the meaning. So I don't know. You can kind of play around with this mentally, I suppose. If you're having any trouble with this, just try to convert some of these things and see which ones can be converted and which ones can't. I think you'll kind of get the gist of it after a while. Sometimes it's hard to put it in words, but if you remember that one thing, the relative pronoun that's in the nominative case can be converted to a participial construction. Otherwise, it can't be. Okay, so those are some of the stickier points as far as the grammar is concerned there, the things that we need to be familiar with. The rest of the chapter deals with other relatives here. He does, in section 316, get a little bit into these ideas of cause and so forth, indicating cause and purpose. Those things are mainly contextual again. So I don't want you to get the idea that using a relative pronoun can give you the meaning of because. It's not just the relative pronoun. It's the relative pronoun plus the context, plus the situation, and so forth. So I think we've talked about that before, so I don't want to belabor it now. We'll finish up on this next time. Yeah?
On these other relatives?
Yes, I'd like you to... I'll take a look at these next time, and I think... as far as vocabulary is concerned, you should be familiar with these. Most of these, the most of them are adverbs. Those aren't going to be any problem as far as declension is concerned. And the adjectives, hoios, so forth, osos, those are declined, but those are straightforward. I think we'll have to be familiar with those, yeah. And then the next chapter, too, on coordinating conjunctions and subordinating, those will be mostly vocabulary as well. All right. So much for that for now. We'll continue this review next Tuesday. Okay.
3 days.
3 days. I wonder if I... Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Did this roll book make it around everybody? I guess everybody who was here got it last time. Okay.
Question to do with Greek.
Okay.
It deals with the Hebrew word
Hadad,
which means blood.
Yeah.
And I think a few times that
that one is a numerical one.
Absolutely.
Not a one.